Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to the DWRL-hosted podcast. I'm Lily Zhu, a PhD candidate in the English department, and I'm here with Professor Patrick Yagoda, who is our guest for the 2016-2017 TILTS series. Professor Yagoda is an associate professor of English and cinema and media studies at the University of Chicago, specializing in media studies, 20th and 21st century American literature, and digital game theory and design. He is co-founder of the Game Changer Chicago Design Lab, as well as the Transmedia Story Lab, the latter of which explores how digital media and certain narrative forms can influence health policies and the field of public health. Professor Yagoda is also author of the recently published book, Network Aesthetics. All right, and so for each question, if you could just say your name before you provide a question, that'd be great.
Hi, I'm Amy, and I just wanted to know if you could explain or describe to us a little bit, just to start us off and to get us thinking about these things, your concept of network and aesthetics, and then this idea of network aesthetics that you're kind of bringing to the forefront in your book.
Sure. Thanks for that question. So basically, when I started working on this book, Network Aesthetics, I was thinking about how abstract and how movable the term network had become by the 1990s and the 2000s. Namely, we use the word network to describe economies and terrorist assemblages and the brain, right? So it has these metaphorical functions, but also a kind of deep materiality given our communications climate in that same period. So I was really interested in thinking about how problems of global connectedness were linked to this idea of the network imaginary. And by network imaginary, I mean this kind of complex of material infrastructures and metaphorical figures that inform the ways that many of us experience the contemporary social world. Of course, that's variable across transnational contexts and across different kinds of cultures. I mean, my book focuses mostly on an American context, but it, of course, intersects with various kinds of international and transnational issues as well. So because I'm coming from an English background and a media studies background, I was especially interested in aesthetics, right? So how do networks become represented? And Alexander Galloway, a really fantastic media theorist, has made the argument that we basically have one dominant way of representing networks, and that's in these graphs of nodes and links. And I think that's true. I mean, the majority of representations or some version of that. But I was also interested in taking a kind of comparative media studies approach and thinking about how different art forms, how different narrative forms give us various versions of the network. So how the novel versus the film versus the television show versus the video game, for instance, takes us to different representations and different experiences of networks. If it didn't answer your question, feel free to follow up, too.
Hi, this is Jake. Building off that explanation of networks, you say that you're comparing or want to look at the comparison or the differences between narratives of film and TV, the novel. Do you see any emergent narrative form that is native to or specific to the internet, and what examples might you give, and how might that be different from other narrative forms like the novel?
Sure. And actually, the way that I organize the book is that the first half has to do with linear narrative forms, and the second half has to do with mostly nonlinear forms that are a little bit more native to online environments, let's say. So there we can think about things like Twitter plays, for instance, or alternate reality games, or different forms of transmedia storytelling, or, you know, even the kinds of narratives and conversations that happen around speedruns in video games, for instance. I mean, those are all instances in which networks aren't merely being represented or thematized, but networks are crucial to the forms of sociality and the kinds of aesthetics that become possible on the other end. I think that these, you know, historically, these kinds of new forms have sometimes been approached by conventional fields as ephemera. And you know, I just don't think that we can do that anymore. I mean, more and more, these are forms that are getting millions of people involved in one way or another, and even if they don't last that long, it's really important to historically and theoretically think about how they're influencing culture. And there are many others that one can name. I mean, those forms that I named come immediately to mind. And I'm a little bit biased toward games, right? So like pervasive games, different kinds of online game experiments, virtual worlds I would add to that list, things like that.
I'm Sarah. My question is a little more, a little broader. I don't know if this is really like the right time for it, but I've been thinking a lot about artistic practice in the digital humanities. I've noticed just a lot of experimental work that's been coming out of that field, and your work seems to plug into that a little bit, and I was just wondering if you could just say something about that, why you think that's important, or just your thoughts on that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, it's a really good question. And when I think about the role of making or the arts within the humanities, I usually go to terms like practice-based research and critical making. And I like critical making partly because it's, you know, conscious of all of these kind of non-academic contexts, like, you know, crafts making in independent communities and things like that, or, you know, or different forms of kind of like zine production or video game production, but also combining that with the critical or with forms of critique. So for me, when I make objects, it's not always about a polished product that could be put out into the world. It's more about making something in order to have a different kind of thought, right? I mean, certainly, like, if you read philosophy or critical theory, which is what most of my training was in, that gets you to a certain sequence of thought. But if you make a video game that requires, for instance, interviews and human-centered design and all kinds of processes that aren't common to the humanities, it may lead you to thinking about concepts in slightly different ways. So one quick example that I could give of this is, you know, I became really interested in the concept of failure in different ways. And at the end of my network aesthetics book, for instance, I, as a case study, created an alternate reality game as a way of talking about alternate reality games, because it's very hard to participate in a form that's that ephemeral or transitory, right? So it was easier to make the thing in order to bring up different problematics that are proper to it. And there, you know, some things didn't work about the game. And that gave me a way of thinking about failure not just as something that doesn't lead to success, but also as something that maybe has a kind of inherent value. So I'm thinking about, you know, like, people in the corporate world talk about failure in one way. People in queer theory, for instance, talk about it in a very different way. So Jack Halberstam, for instance, has like a really interesting theory of queer failure and the ways in which like failure and non-sovereignty and precarity lead to different kinds of thoughts than those coming from kind of sovereign and powerful positions. So for me, making an object was a way of inhabiting those kinds of ideas, like, in a less abstract way, I guess. And I think, like, in the digital humanities, in new media studies, in some interdisciplinary fields like the medical humanities, there's a lot of space for that kind of scholar practitioner work going forward. And my, like, the work that I do is just a very small subset of what's possible. There are amazing digital humanities projects that, you know, have to do with archives, with programs, with cultural works and things like that.
Hi, my name is Joseph Brittlinger. I go by JB. And you said that you like video games. You say that you like new media, et cetera. How do you think we're using these digital media to make arguments? And how is it different from the way in which we used to make arguments, in your opinion?
So I really like Ian Bogost's idea of procedural rhetoric, for instance, right? And one of the arguments that he makes is, when we think about rhetoric traditionally, we think about it in the context of writing or written text or oral communication. But of course, and you know, the people in this room know this material better than I do, but then you have forms of visual or media rhetoric that don't depend on text in quite the same way. And Ian Bogost's argument is that video games take us into yet another space of procedural rhetoric where they use processes and mechanics and rules and things that are proper to games in order to make arguments, right? So in a game, it's not necessarily the representation of a character. It's not necessarily the graphics that are persuading you of something. It's the thing that you do. It's the action that you take. And so I think that becomes a really interesting space for designers to think about how to rewire people's habits and actions and movements and ways of being in the world, rather than simply focusing on a level of kind of cognitive cerebral argumentation.
Hi, I'm Regina, and I have probably a little just more concrete question related to games, because I love video games. And one thing that I just kind of, and me and Lily have talked about this before, is like when it comes to like criticism and critique of video games, the kind of really like the big divide between the fact that there are people who play video games have a lot of critique of different ways, that it's very different from like game studies people. I wonder if there are any particular like websites or people that you feel like really speak to or help kind of bridge that divide between kind of the academic and the non-academic ways in which we think about games.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I'm finding more and more that my current graduate students, people coming into graduate school now, are willing to move across that divide quite a bit, right, where video games aren't merely an academic area of study, aren't merely drawing on play studies or game studies or things like that, but are also bringing in aspects of their experience, their love of the medium growing up, things of that nature. You know, I mean, I think though a lot of the kind of core practitioners and theorists within game studies are themselves also kind of, you know, are amateurs in the sense of like loving video games in the first place. So Ian Bogost, whom I just mentioned, certainly Mary Flanagan, who right does this kind of more avant-garde art version of games, but plays them herself, and so forth. And I think like more and more you also see people in game studies who are themselves game designers at the same time, and that adds a third element into it, where you're not just playing and writing about them, but you're also trying to create games that maybe fix some of the problems that you see with contemporary game design. You know, and I think this doesn't just happen in academia. You also see, you know, starting in, I don't know, somewhere between 2008 and 2010, you see really great feminist game designers, trans game designers, you know, people like Anna Anthropy, Maddie Bryce, you know, Mary Flanagan going further back, who are really, again, not just criticizing existing games, but putting forth their own preferable versions or alternatives to the limitations of the medium.
Hi, it's Amy again. I want to go back to this idea of alternate reality games, and I know you talked about it last night, but and this is going to be a bit politically charged, this question, so here we go. So if we're thinking of alternate reality games as like forms of improvisation or non-sovereign narratives, maybe we could call them that, then how might we like think about, what are some ways in which perhaps we could think about these alternate reality games as forms of improvisation or non-sovereign narratives and their relationship to, let's say, truth or fact-based inquiry, mm-hmm. right? Or to expertise, like these paradigms of expertise?
So I'll try to answer the question, and if I don't, please actively ask a follow-up question. The thing I love about alternate reality games is they're not designed for individuals. They're designed for a multiplayer experience, or even more than that, I would say, a collective experience. And so, you know, one of the historical examples of this was the game The Beast, which came out in 2001, and kind of infamously, the game designers created 3 months' worth of content that the players then solved in 3 days. Right, so there was this kind of banding together of all of these different skill sets that exceeded the designers' expectations of what the players could achieve, and the designers then also learned that, you know, people if they're motivated, are really good at collaboration, are really good at organization. And I think as a result of that kind of moment, ARG designers have oftentimes created challenges that are targeted at different kinds of skill sets. So certainly when I create ARGs, I'll have music puzzles, I'll have puzzles that benefit people who have a kind of literary background, I'll build in, you know, math and physics puzzles. And there I think facts and forms of expertise become crucial to solving puzzles and moving forward with the overall game. And for me, you know, puzzles and challenges aren't necessarily the heart of an ARG, but they're an element of it, and they're a way of maintaining forms of learning and forms of knowledge within an art form that is also at the same time grounded upon deception, right? I mean, you have this is not a game aesthetic, so you're not telling people that they're playing a game. So there is this kind of foundational deception that comes with the form, but that doesn't mean that it's entirely, you know, free of facts or thinking or knowledge or things like that.
So just to follow up, what is that, in how you see it, what does that get us in terms of that, like, motivation toward collaboration and that ability to draw on different kinds of skill sets? What does that get us in terms of, like, what does that collaboration get us in terms of some kind of I don't know, political or social value?
I mean, I could give you the safe answer and the unsafe answer, so I'll probably give you both. I mean, the safer answer is, especially in a kind of university environment, collaboration is really beneficial at not merely giving lip service to interdisciplinarity, but actually engaging in the interdisciplinarity. For undergraduates, I think it's really useful in terms of making them more adaptable to different jobs and careers and pathways that they might take after graduation. I mean, the other kind of answer that I could give is, I think we're seeing the benefits of collaboration right now in this moment in, like, early February 2017, where we have these unexpected protests and marches taking place on essentially a weekly basis in a country where those protests have been pretty small and pretty infrequent over the last few years. And so I think, like, learning how to collaborate and organize, especially using digital tools and social media, becomes increasingly important in a politically challenging, you know, and kind of agonistic climate. So I do think that these kinds of soft skills, like collaboration within an alternate reality game, can then be taken up by students and activists and artists in ways that they weren't necessarily intended by the game designers. And I think that could be really generative.
We sat there and went, hey.
I'm Sarah again. What advice do you have for younger scholars who might like to do more experimental projects like the ones that you're doing? How would you suggest that they get support for those ideas, etc.?
My main advice is that if you work on experimental projects, be sure to write about them. Right, I mean, there's still a kind of divide between theory and practice in the work that we do within the humanities. I don't necessarily agree with that divide personally, but when you're looking at dissertation committees, tenure committees, things like that, these are people who still oftentimes, right, care about that divide. So the more often you're able to take some experience that you had or some making projects that you were a part of and create concepts out of that or create historical arguments out of that or create formal arguments out of that, I think the better your chances are of kind of building up your own portfolio or your CV, or just your experience. And I think more and more there are really interesting journals that are publishing multimedia work or transmedia work, right, that gives you credit for the work that you're doing, but maybe just not according to the conventional means of publication. So Kairos is an example of a kind of, you know, online journal that's been around for a long time that publishes short documentary works or web texts or really any form that you can think of. So that would be part of it. In terms of funding your projects, there are probably different pathways to this. I mean, I would definitely recommend finding your peer group and creating collaborations across boundaries. You know, I can program a little bit, but I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a developer. And so from a very early moment, I knew that I had to team up with people who were better at game development or better at programming than I would ever be, no matter how much time I put into that. And so rather than trying to do it all yourself, I would say, try to find your team early. So even when I was at Duke, kind of transitioning from being a grad student to being an assistant professor, or really to being a postdoc, I started working with Patrick Lemieux, who's now at UC Davis, and Catherine Hales, who's a professor at Duke, and we worked on an alternate reality game together. That was a really amazing experience because each of us and the undergraduates who were working with us all had different skill sets and allowed us to get further more quickly because we had those. As far as finding funding, I mean, I know there are a lot of opportunities at UT to do that, but another idea for that is just to also connect to faculty members who are able to be PIs, principal investigators, on larger projects. And oftentimes they can apply for larger grants that might get you support, right, to work on a project, including financial support, and might give you a leg up in terms of whatever you're doing next. I hope that's practical enough. Yeah. I can get more practical.
So, related question. This is Jake again. Hi. Your work spans a number of different fields and disciplines. You work in an English department. Your visit here is focused on video game studies. You do film and media studies. Not all of us have found it so easy to work across so many fields and disciplines. There's typically a lot of pushback to narrow one's focus and talk about just one thing at a time. So, could you maybe talk about, to some degree, the pushbacks you've had to face in finding yourself at those intersections and how you overcame those pushbacks?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the reason that I've worked across disciplines as much as I have is that I've been very driven by problems rather than responses to things in the literature. I mean, of course, like when one does research, you're in conversation with many different scholars, but there are, you know, some problems when you pose them, you find that in order to answer them, you have to move across a number of different fields. You have to engage in, you know, an older idiom for this would be like Levi-Strauss talking about bricolage or something like that, right? You move to the knowledge that is at hand, that's necessary for answering that question. But, you know, I agree with you that there are people for whom that isn't necessarily a satisfying orientation. And so when I first started working with Melissa Gilliam, who's the doctor, the OBGYN with whom I work on the game work with, there was certainly some pushback among, you know, certain peers in the humanities who saw this as being a kind of fun side project, but not the core of my research. And it was really through publication and through writing up each of the projects that I worked on that I was able to sort of stake this ground of practice-based research as being real research, maybe looking a little bit different than a close reading of a novel would look or a kind of formal analysis or, you know, something like that. But that it still had a kind of value that could move into different kinds of disciplines. So my, you know, my main thought is, if you can justify the work that you're doing methodologically, and if you can justify it in terms of implications and the so what of what you're doing, people will give you a little bit more leeway in terms of where you go and the kind of work that you do. You know, it's harder, I think, when you're a graduate student and when you're a junior faculty member, where there are still fairly traditional expectations in most departments across the humanities, across the United States. And so you do have to be a little bit more careful. But more and more, there are organizations and there are senior faculty who really believe in this kind of work and are able to support junior scholars. So for me, from a very early moment in my time at Duke University, I was part of HASTAC, the Humanities, Arts, Science, and Technology Advanced Collaboratory that was started by a few different people, including Kathy Davidson and David Theo Goldberg. And Kathy Davidson happened to be at Duke. And I remember when I was working on my dissertation was in many ways very traditional. I mean, I was doing close readings of novels. I was doing very little work in media studies. I was doing very little work in video games at that point. I mean, it was really a post-45 American studies and literature project. But at the very end of my dissertation time, Kathy Davidson basically pushed me to, you know, as I was moving from the dissertation to the book, to really bring some of my knowledge and some of my passion about digital culture into the book project. And so it was lucky mentorship, it was good mentorship from people like that that helped me be a little bit more risky and also gave me a little bit more of a safety net in moving into those kinds of projects. So as with anything else, I think the network that you form, right, or the group that you're a part of can give you slightly more safety in engaging in more experimental projects.
Hi, I'm Andy. Just like going outwards a little bit. It seems like in your work you talk about networks as both like theoretical images and also empirical entities that exist in the world. So I guess my question is like, how do we navigate this dichotomy? It seems like there's kind of an epistemic and ontological battle in the idea of networks. So how do we think about them in terms of them being stable entities that exist that we've kind of deduce, or versus the kind of abductive quality of seeing networks everywhere?
Right, so I mean, it's a question about epistemology and ontology and thinking about the kind of network imaginary. I mean, as somebody who's coming from an English department, I really believe that what we do in culture, the kinds of images that we create, the kinds of stories that we create, impact the sciences, impact policymaking, impact technology in countless different ways. And so I think the stories that we tell about networks and the forms of network art that we engage in, even if indirectly, right, influence all kinds of things that are happening in the realm of big data and algorithms and network thought. So for instance, we can find various representations of terrorist networks across literature, across film. I mean, I write about the film Syriana, for instance, which is all about terrorist networks and uses different cinematic tools in order to convey something about comparative networks between, say, terrorism and sovereign nation states. And I think sitting with a text like Syriana gives one different kinds of insights when you move back into the realm of policymaking or back into the realm of making real-world decisions. With the terrorist network, I mean, one thing that I bring up in the book is, you know, the term terrorist network is essentially an oxymoron, right? You're taking something extremely destructive, terrorism, something that's associated with violence, and you're connecting it with a term network, which is all about connection, right? So destructive connection, essentially. And one of the questions that I have in that chapter is like, what is the utility from a political standpoint of positing something like a terrorist network rather than, you know, a group of terrorists or a single terrorist? And part of it has to do with how the distribution of a network, the decentralization of a network, can produce forms of fear. Right? If something is networked and you don't know where to center it and you don't know how to destroy it, that's going to generate a lot more fear in a population. And of course, we've seen that kind of political rhetoric taken up for years and years and years. I mean, it happened during the George W. Bush administration. It happened around the early Iraq War. And so one doesn't even have to move into literature or cinema or cultural studies in order to make these kinds of observations. But I do think that that's a place in which, like, the language of networks and the image of a network has consequences in terms of the kinds of policies that get passed or whether or not a war takes place.
My name's Matt. So I'm going to shift again. Go back. So in games that have resulted in these unexpected user experiences or unexpected outcomes. Is there anything common in the design of these games that might generate or promote those kind of more spontaneous user reactions beyond the intentionality of the design itself?
Yeah, I mean, somebody used the word sandbox earlier, right? I mean, sort of sandbox games or open-ended games right, there are all these games in which the player experience isn't on rails, isn't particularly linear, isn't constrained by the puzzles or the challenges that one is undertaking. You know, even a game like Grand Theft Auto, for instance, or that whole series, encourages a lot of emergent behavior because it's more focused on the open-ended world than it is on any series of tasks. And so I think games like that tend to create more interesting responses or emergent actions. But even, you know, this has to do as much with video game culture as video game design. So if you watch speedrunners of games, whether they're old NES games or contemporary PlayStation 4 games, speedrunners will oftentimes find exploits and find different ways of moving through a game space that maybe wasn't intended by designers, but that allows like emergent forms of actions or what my friends Stephanie Bollock and Patrick Lemieux call metagames. So there's this whole realm of metagames that happens in speedrunning, that happens in competitive esports, that happens in different kinds of communities in the video game world. I mean, one game that I write about that I think is a good example of this is the That Game Company game, Journey. So Journey, I'm curious how many people here have played Journey. So one, or maybe a couple. So Journey is an art game that takes maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and you start as this robed figure who's moving across a vast desert. And you figure out and you're moving toward this mountain in the background, but you don't exactly know why you're doing this because there's no language in the game. There's no text, there's no voice communication. In fact, at first you think you're playing a single player game. But as you start playing the game, you realize, oh, there's another person in the game, and that person is not a non-player character, it's not an NPC. That other player is like here with me across the network. Except, again, you can't communicate with that person except for the movements that you take in the game and the mechanics in which you engage. And so it's a game that encourages forms of communication but also forecloses them at the same time. And for me, when I was studying this game, I thought to myself, well, I'm really interested in affect. I'm really interested in these forms of emergent sociality. But how do you study that if nobody's actually communicating in the game? And so what I did was I turned to a secondary archive, basically a Tumblr blog, where people who had just played the game were reporting on what their experience of the game was like, right? So this like wordless game generated essentially this excess of language on the other end and gave us a way into better understanding what was going on there. But also with that game, the emergent action wasn't just about competition or completing the game more quickly or more effectively. It was also people feeling things that they had never felt before playing a game, feeling sadness, feeling a sense of distance, feeling a sense of intimacy with this person with whom they couldn't have a verbal relationship. And those forms of affect to me are particularly interesting in these kind of emergent situations, regardless of where they come from. And I'm certainly interested going forward in designing in such a way that those forms of improvisation and playback become more possible.
This is Lily, and I have a question regarding that player, participant, and designer interaction with mutual changes. So most of the games I play, like League of Legends or like Guild Wars 2, they are constantly incomplete. They rely on patches and updates to update game mechanics or characters or aesthetics. But a lot of those design updates are in reaction to player demands. Mm-hmm. So would that be considered a type of alternate reality in which these digital games turn real for the players, and now we are in a universe where the players are also creating the game, and then the designers implement those changes?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that example is interesting, but it belongs more to the realm of consumption and user experience in some ways, right? So certainly around the moment of what Henry Jenkins at an earlier moment called convergence culture, right, we had this a different kind of communication taking place between consumers and producers. So, I mean, this happens on TV too, right? So an early example would be a television show like Lost, where there was not only a large group of viewers, but those viewers were also having communications online, coming up with different conspiracy theories, trying to guess where the show was going. And of course, the showrunners and the writers were reading that and being influenced by those kinds of responses. And in an earlier moment in television, you didn't quite have that speed and that intensity of bidirectional conversation. And so that level of influence was lesser. Now we have it all the time. It certainly happens in the realm of virtual worlds and online games on a very regular basis, and oftentimes I think does have interesting creative results. And sometimes players don't rely on producers to give them what they want. So I even think about this virtual world practice of theory crafting, for instance, right? When a new patch or a new update comes up, right, these people who know math, who know the game really well, will come up with calculations as to what the kind of like ideal attacks are or the ideal combinations of different moves might be. And that's a way of them basically saying, I don't care what the game designers and the producers are doing. We're gonna take the constraints of what they've produced and we'll find our own way of playing the game. So that becomes another interesting, I think, kind of either player-oriented or consumer-oriented practice.
It looks like we've reached a good stopping point. So thank you for coming, everyone, and thank you for such a wonderful conversation, Patrick.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.